Hello, and welcome once again to Bristol Classical Podcasts. We're continuing our exploration of Virgil's Aeneid, and in this episode we're looking at Aeneid Book 4. I'm joined today by Alice Constable, who's one of our MA students in the department, studying for an MA in Classics and Ancient History, and Ika Willis, who is the faculty lecturer in reception. The usual general question to start things off: what would you say was the major theme or themes of the fourth book of the Aeneid?
I think the major thing about the fourth book of the Aeneid is the conflict between love and war, or also kind of very closely related to that, the conflict between personal fulfillment, personal desire, personal happiness, and one's duty to one's state. So the main plot of Aeneid 4 is about Dido and Aeneas. Dido is the queen of Carthage, and Aeneas is the hero of the Aeneid, who I expect you're all familiar with already. Aeneas has been shipwrecked in Carthage. Dido has fallen crazy in love with him, and they have a kind of brief relationship of a sort, which I expect Alice and I will be talking about at some length throughout this podcast. The nature of it is slightly unclear. They have some kind of relationship, which is then ended when the king of the gods, Jupiter, sends Mercury to make Aeneid get on with his quest and just say, stop wasting time with this girl and get on with the city foundation. So that conflict, which seems really simple, but is very complicated in lots of ways, is at the heart of the book, I think.
Yes, I think a huge problem with it is the conflict between love and fate, and it's constantly going on throughout the whole of the Aeneid, really, all throughout the destruction of Troy. Aeneas constantly ignoring his destiny and his fate, and it's once again here where he's ignoring what he wants to do, staying around in Carthage, and has to get prompted to get a move on and leave.
And it makes the book, I think, really... This is one of the books of the Aeneid that gets read a lot, and it gets read a lot in isolation, and it's also been adapted a lot in isolation. So Christopher Marlowe wrote a play based on it, Purcell wrote an opera based on it, and Chaucer, in The House of Fame, does a kind of very brief recap of the Aeneid, which goes, Aeneas leaves Troy, and then he meets Dido, and then we get 300 lines on how brilliant Dido is, and how perfidious Aeneas is, and how he broke her heart, and he was a faithless man, and he was wicked, and oh yeah, he said that God told him to go to Italy, and then he left her, and we go back to Dido. So it sounds like, particularly in the context of this kind of big Latin epic, it sounds like a really sort of misogynistic or a really kind of a setup. It sounds like here's Aeneas, he's righteous, and there's this wicked woman trying to seduce him away from his destiny. Then he leaves her, hurrah, and she kills herself, and then we're all happy because the wicked woman is dead and the man is back on track. But it doesn't feel like that, I think, when you read it.
I think that's only to us as modern readers. I think part of the problem is that we've been so used to having a canonical reading of Aeneid 4, which has been passed down generations and generations, because obviously Latin literature was pretty much read by a male elite, and they were all taught the set way and what was correct. And I think it's only because it's been recently we've been able to actually have a look at this and maybe sympathise with Dido a little more, and perhaps she isn't the cruel, suspicious queen that perhaps she could be portrayed. Isn't quite so... Well, she is irrational, but...
So it's partly because we're not Romans, so we don't have so much at stake in, you know, get on with the proper story, go and found Rome. And it's partly we're not elite male Romans, so we don't buy into quite the same sort of disparaging view of Dido. And presumably it's partly, it's almost we're looking for a different sort of story. We're less interested in the epic bits and actually a nice tragic love story. Certainly if you look at, you know, Purcell's opera, this, you know, this is what is easily dramatisable into an opera.
And the thing I love, I think that's entirely true, but the thing I love about Purcell's opera in particular is, okay, and this is going to get at your question, Neville, and I think your point too, Alice, that yes, I think that's true. I think we like that aspect of the story more, but it's always been there. It has now always been in the text. Certainly Ovid was writing a letter from Dido, which is very much, oh, you wicked man, why do you abandon me? Love is more important than war, because I'm an elegiac poet, not an epic poet. And so I think this is the interesting thing about Aeneid Book 4, is Dido, is Dido's suffering. And we can just kind of forget about Aeneas. And then Chaucer, who's another, I don't know how elite he was, but certainly male writer, and Purcell and so forth. So there is, although it's a modern reading, there is also a tradition that it's tapping into. And I think that can only happen if that conflict is really at the heart of Book 4.
So does this mean that actually the portrayal of Dido is sort of complex and ambiguous, even in Virgil? It's not just that later readers can see a more sympathetic character.
I think there is a problem because she is a complex character, and I think part of the problem is that she's the queen, she's the sole ruler, she's a woman instead of being a man. And I think the big problem here and the massive conflict that happens because she's a woman doing a male role in a traditionally male society. And I feel almost throughout Book 4 there's a bit of a role reversal where Dido is in charge, she's the queen, she knows exactly what's going on, she takes Aeneas around her city, shows off her realm. But Aeneas is almost the passive one that says very little, even when Dido's screaming at him for leaving her, he doesn't really say anything at all. Pretty much the main, only really active thing he does is tell his men to get the ships ready and gets on the ship, which I think could almost be part of the problem that Virgil's highlighting here.
As it came up in one of the earlier podcasts, Dido as powerful female ruler, therefore from a Roman point of view, anomalous and troubling and terribly reminiscent of Cleopatra, if you, you know, make the sort of contemporary sort of political connection.
I think that's true. I also think, again, possibly from a modern point of view, there is something more interesting and complicated going on with Dido, partly because she is, her situation is more sympathetically portrayed, I think, than one might think. So the thing with Dido is she had a first husband called Sichaeus, who she loved very dearly, and he died. I think he was murdered and she got into a kind of revenge war, and then she ended up in Carthage founding a city, and she has only managed to maintain her role as the very vulnerable female leader of a state by putting off suitors. So it's a bit like Penelope in the Odyssey. She can only maintain her role as actually in charge of what's going on if she doesn't remarry. And the only way that she can manage to not remarry is by being conspicuously chaste and conspicuously faithful to her dead husband. And then the gods get involved, Juno and Venus get involved and start kind of messing with the mortal emotions, to the point where Dido believes that she has now married Aeneas. They have contracted a political alliance as much as anything else. There's a bit back in Book 1 where she says, I will treat Trojans and Tyrians with no discrimination. There will be no political difference between them. We will merge into a single citizen body. And I think she thinks with her marriage to Aeneas, she's accomplished this. And she's actually contracted a workable political alliance. But what brilliantly happens in Book 4 is we never see Dido and we never see what happens between Dido and Aeneas. We have very few scenes of them alone together, and when we do, it's after the breakup when Dido is shouting at Aeneas, and Aeneas is not telling us anything. So Dido and Aeneas, when they get together, it's in a cave, and at the point where they go down to the cave, we kind of, the camera almost pulls back, it's very filmic, and we get a long shot of the landscape in which the cave is, and we say, and Dido was the matron of honour, and the nymphs ululated, and they celebrated what looks like a marriage ceremony. Then they come out of the cave, and Dido, and we're told, again in these very abstract terms, Dido called it marriage. So we don't know whether it was a marriage or not. All we know is that she called it marriage. And as soon as she says marriage, that word gets picked up by Rumour, which is personified as this kind of terrifying monster, and it goes all round the neighbouring kingdoms and gets picked up by King Iarbas, who is one of the unsuccessful suitors who wants to marry Dido and get the kingdom for himself. So as soon as she wavers from this stance of, I cannot remarry, I cannot share my kingdom with a man because I am faithful to my dead husband, that's instantly used against her. King Iarbas starts kind of making noises about declaring war on her. And Jupiter hears from Iarbas' prayers. So we're not following what's happening with Dido and Aeneas. We're only following what's said about them. So then Jupiter hears that Dido and Aeneas have got together and sends Mercury to pull Aeneas back onto the path. So there's a very complicated set of political negotiations that are being messed up by this, for Dido, by this relationship with Aeneas. And I think that's shown to us fairly clearly, even in the original text, even before we start kind of trying to recuperate Dido from a Roman misogynistic reading. I think there is enough in the original text that we can see the whole story from her point of view as well as from Aeneas's.
But we're still left not being certain exactly what happened.
No.
Why?
Well, I think there's a problem, really, and Ica and I had a little argument about this before. Does Aeneas actually love Dido? And I'm inclined to say no, because I don't think he's a particularly emotional person, really. His emotion is shown through his piety. He's constantly being referred to as pious Aeneas. And that is his emotion. That's it. And I think it's a sort of loyalty and affection towards this idea of the state that he, yes, only adopts as he leaves Troy, but it's the love for sort of Anchises and Ulysses is, you know, he helps them throughout, he carries Anchises out of Troy, Ulysses becomes his successor. And it's sort of demonstrated through his piety and his desire to fulfil his destiny and his fate. And his love for Dido and his first wife, Creusa, who dies in Troy, there it's not important, and therefore they're both abandoned.
That's really interesting, and I find it's hard to defend Aeneas against that, because he says this to Dido. She says, oh my god, you never loved me, and he's like, well, you know, if I had my way, I would never have come to Carthage, I would still be in Troy, but since I have cut, and now I have to go to Italy, this is my love, this is my fatherland, hic amor, haec patriest. So he does explicitly say to Dido, no, I don't love you, I love my destiny. But throughout book four in particular, we keep getting these little indications or reminders that we don't know what's going on for Aeneas. Again, Virgil tells us at a certain point that he does love Dido, or that he is very distressed, very moved, very unhappy about the prospect of having to leave her. But he never tells Dido this, and we get almost nothing from her point of view, from his point of view, sorry, we get a lot from Dido's point of view. But Aeneas, we don't enter. And you can take that either way. I think, Alice, you're as I say, it's very hard to rebut you, because that's certainly there, and I feel betraying my sisters to say this, but I think there's also a way of reading book four where it is Aeneas's tragedy, where to some extent it's all very well for Dido, she can, you know, dance around and rant and rave and perform hideous sacrifices and do black magic rituals and stray all over the city like a bacchant and be crazy and irrational, but Aeneas never gets to do that because he has this completely joyless life where he has this fantastic relationship with Dido, which he just has to give up for his father and his son. There's a moment, I mean, again, if you look at the book through the prophecies, both Jupiter and Mercury say to Aeneas, okay, you might not want to go to Italy, but you have to go there because it's Ulysses' destiny to become the king, so you owe it to your son. I don't care what you want. And Aeneas is like, okay, well, you know, I'll do it for the future, because my point of view has absolutely nothing to recommend it. And then Dido actually gets a prophecy towards the end of the book where she says, okay, maybe you are fated to start this new land, this new state in Italy, but I hope you have a really miserable time, and I hope you die alone and friendless, and I hope it's all rubbish for you. And it is. We know from the later myth of Aeneas, he is going to have a horrible life. He's going to be married to this useless princess, Lavinia, for about 5 minutes. He's going to die before their first child is born. And he's doing all of this for absolutely no personal reward. And there's, I don't know if it's some kind of nostalgic kind of 19th century fetishism of this great statesman, but there's something a bit great about that. There's something a bit fabulous about Aeneas.
Well, I hate to use this sort of modern term, but could we possibly argue that Aeneas is on the rebound? I mean, yes, all right, the death of Creusa at the beginning is, it's sad, it's emotional, but, and Aeneas doesn't really show emotions throughout, but he does shed a tear, which, you know, for Aeneas is pretty good going. If we look back at book two and Aeneas' story, he's reciting the account of Troy. He's very, very fond of it. He clearly misses his lifestyle there. And I think Carthage is something comforting to him. He's got a position of power. He's got a position of responsibility. He's in a nice city. It's clearly strong. Got a good military. It's powerful. And perhaps the only reason he's actually in Carthage and stays around for so long is because it's comforting, rather than any particular love for the city and love for Dido.
Yeah, again, it's almost impossible to tell because we never get a sense of Aeneas's. We never find out whether they're married, which means it is impossible, going way, way back to Neville's question, it's impossible to make a moral judgment on Aeneas, and I think that's very deliberate. It's impossible to make a judgment on whether he is abandoning a marriage or whether this is just, you know, crazy Dido going, you know, you slept with me, that means we must be together. Sorry, I'm modernising again. But whether you have this kind of this woman insisting on a commitment in the absence of Aeneas making that commitment, or whether Aeneas actually does consider himself married to Dido. We are never allowed to find out. We're never allowed to find out what Aeneas thinks he owes to Dido. So it's very unclear whether he's what his investment is in Dido, what his investment is in Carthage. And I think there's a broader problem about heterosexuality in the Aeneid, because we see Aeneas with these three women. We have Creusa, who dies in this tragic accident whereby Aeneas says, I'm going to keep my husband and, my father and my son very close to me in my arms, and you, wife, could you follow along a fair distance behind me in the middle of a war zone? Oh, look, she's died. We then have this possibly very passionate, possibly very comforting, possibly just lazy sort of, I should be on a quest, but this lady seems to want me to stay here, relationship with Dido. And then we get this completely enigmatic figure, Lavinia, who we know Aeneas is going to end up with. But none of them motivate him. None of them are really, in narrative terms, Creusa is just kind of there, and then she's not. And then she gives a prophecy about how he should go to another land and marry another lady. Dido is simply, narratively, is simply a stumbling block and is there to some extent to set up the historical enmity between Rome and Carthage. So all the women have a kind of historical aspect of statesmanship. Creusa is the state that he's left. Dido is a kind of enemy state, and Lavinia is the state that he's going to found. But his relationships with them don't motivate any of the action, and his relationships with the men do. It's his relationship with Pallas, the son of Evander, that at the end of the Aeneid is going to motivate the famous and very problematic ending where he kills Turnus while he's down. His relationship with his father, his desire to see his dead father, is called on a lot in book four, when he will again say to Dido, you don't matter to me as much as my dead father does, or you don't matter to me as much as my son does. And then in book six he will actually go to the underworld to see his dead father. So his relationships with men are what drives the narrative, and consistently the women in the epic are just there to hold up progress or to kind of illuminate something about state relationships. But Aeneas's own feelings for these women remain completely opaque, I think, at all times.
Do you think that's possibly just due to the sort of different social status between men and women in Rome, or because Virgil wanted to particularly emphasise a homosexual relationship?
It's really hard to know.
I mean, I was wondering about this, that, you know, we have a tendency to focus on Aeneid as the individual character and debate, you know, is it that he's, we feel rather sorry for him, that he's driven by this sense of duty and destiny, and occasionally, you know, gods turn up and sort of tell him get on with it? Or is he this sort of emotional void or whatever? And a third option is to say, well, this is about Roman values which are not our values. What matters is the patrilineal succession. The women are there to further the patrilineal succession, but actually your son is always more important than your wife, and your father is more important than your wife. Again, you know, what he gets in Carthage is the return of political status of a sort, and that has always got to be better than wandering around without any sort of hometown, without any power or identity or whatever. So in a sense, you know, it's whether a Roman audience, Roman male elite audience, would be worrying about the personality of Aeneas in the way that we often do.
It's always a hard one, and it's always difficult to, of course, speculate on the reading habits of people who haven't left that much evidence of their reading habits. But I think one of the things that has been talked about a lot in the scholarship as well by people like Maria Wyck is that simultaneously with the Aeneid, we have an awful lot of elegiac love poetry being produced by, again, elite, by and for elite Roman male audiences. So a lot of that poetry is asking the reader and requiring the writer to inhabit the consciousness of a profoundly emotional and irrational woman. And that, of course, has a kind of political implication in that, you know, you get to play at being an irrational, emotional woman and kind of work off some of your repressed desires to be irrational and emotional in a very safe, controlled literary environment, and then get back on with the important business of ruling the state. But it does, I think, also mean that given the way that the Aeneid as an epic is always in dialogue with other genres, including, I think, love poetry, particularly in book four, and including tragedy, those identificatory structures or those desires to identify with the tragic woman seem to be there in the elite male audience, ready to be unleashed. And it may be that they then instantly get recuperated. So you kind of go, oh, it's so sad about Dido, but it really just goes to prove that the patrilineal succession and the building of the state is the thing. But there is also that moment of subversion. Eve Sedgwick, who's a queer theorist, has this brilliant phrase kinder subversive, kinder hegemonic. And she says that basically this is as far as we've got in the humanities with our reading practices. We read everything and we go, yeah, it's kind of subversive, kind of hegemonic. And that's very much Aeneid for it. It has these moments of what looks like a kind of female sensibility or anarchy or anti-Augustan, anti-male, anti-imperial sensibility. But then it also just kind of is kind of hegemonic as well.
That's a lovely place to end. We're actually out of time, more or less. Thank you very much indeed to you both. And tune in again for Aeneid 5.